Okay, we're beginning here at the bottom of Ayin Chet Amud Bet. The Gemara here is discussing a woman, Hayitata, the Bayi, the Tavrechinu, the Nichsa, Migavra. She wanted to evade having her new husband, her second husband, take possession of her property. She already was an almanat, seemingly a widow from her first marriage. She had property, whether that was property from her husband, property from the original dowry that she brought in, but she had property. Now when she gets married for the second time, she doesn't want this second husband to take the property or to get possession of the property. So therefore she wanted to, from the word barach, she wanted to have the property run away, not be possible for him to take hold of the property. So kadvinu librato. She wrote to her daughter. She basically gifted all of her property to her daughter. In Siva, she got married to the second husband, Vigrisha, and then she got divorced. So she had some premonition that this second marriage may not go and that she didn't want to take in all the property. So she gets married and then she gets divorced. So now she wants her property back because she no longer needs the property away from her husband because her husband doesn't exist anymore. He's out of the picture. Meantime, her daughter has all the property because she wrote a shtar, matana, she wrote a shtar of gifting it to her daughter, and she wants to get the property back, but there's this outstanding shtar that shows that she gifted it all to her daughter. Rashi over here claims, vodiya le'edim, that she made it clear to Edim when she gifted the property to her daughter, she'en matana zu matana ela havriach. This gift was only a gift for the intent of keeping the property away from her husband. She made it explicit why she was gifting it. Rashi makes it explicit. Tosafot disagrees. Tosafot says that she doesn't say anything. But it's obvious from the context that that's what she was doing. She's about to get married, and then she gives all the property to her daughter. So Tosafot over here references what we'll see later on in the Masechta, Daf Tzadi Zayin. Over there, Tosafot discusses three different types of shtarot or circumstances or transactions where one has to explicitly state their intent, where the person does not have to state their intent at all because it's so obvious from the context what their intent is. And then other cases where Dvarim Shebelev Enam Dvarim, where there's no way you can claim that that was the intent of the shtar. So he says that this is one of those circumstances in which they don't need any statement. It's a Gilui Milta. It's so obvious that this was the case, or Anan Sade, that this was the case. So clear here, that's what she was trying to do. So, Atai Lekamei de Rav Nachman. She comes before Rav Nachman. Kare Rav Nachman the Shtara. Nachman just rips up the Shtar. Now, this is not a real Shtar. It was only given to you because she wanted to keep the property away from her husband. Azal Rav Anan Lekamei de Marukva. So Rav Anan, who saw this go on, ran to Marukva. Amalei Chazimar Nachman Chaklaa Heichli Mikra Shtarei De Inche. Do you see the farmer Nachman ripping up shtarot of people? So obviously it was not a term of endearment that he was saying. He was saying this because he was shocked that Rav Nachman would ever do such a thing. Rav Nachman, who was a dayon, acts in this manner. Rav Anan can't believe that he took a real shtar and he ripped it up. And so he says, can you believe Rav Nachman, the farmer, meaning that he's not Baki B'dinim, and how could he tear up the shtar? So Rav Anan runs to Markulkva, who is the Av Beit Din, and says to him, what's going on over here? How could it be that he's doing such a thing? Now, if you remember, we had this back on Daf Samach Ted and with Aleph. Over there, Rav Anan gets himself into trouble with Rav Huna, when he called him Huna Chavre, when he called him Huna our friend, and then Rav Anan runs to Markulkva, and Markulkva says, easy, tell me the whole story. And after he tells him the whole story, he says, if you don't know this information, how are you calling Rav Huna your friend? So similar type of story over here. Seems like Rav Anan had a quick trigger, and he always used to go to Marukva, and then Marukva would straighten him out and put him on the right path. So over here again, So after Rav Anan comes and says this, he says, please tell me what happened with Rav Nachman. He tells him the whole story. So Amalei, Marukva says back to Rav Anan, Shtar Mivrechet Kamart. You're talking about a Shtar Mivrechet, a Shtar that's only purpose is to move possessions away from the control of an individual. Hachar Amir Rabbi Chanilai Baridi Amar Shmuel, Moreh Hora'a Ani. I am a Poseik. I have Reshut from the Reish Galuta to be a Dayan, to give psak halacha, adjudicate. Im yavo shtar mivrechet liyadi, akarenu. If a shtar that's sole purpose is to evade control by another person and it comes into my hands, I'll rip it up. Now, not that he'll rip it up right away, just that he'll rip it up if the receiving party makes a claim that this is a real shtar and they're entitled to the property. That's not what the intent of the shtar. The intent of the shtar is not to give it to this party. It's simply to evade being taken by another party. So Amalei, Rav Huda, Rav Nachman. Time amai, delo shavik inish nafshei, v'yoyiv lachrine. So he says, what's the reason over here behind this idea of the shtar mivrechet? Why do we say... Right, so we'll have that later in the Masechta. He can say dinin dvarim, mainly he can basically abdicate his rights in this situation. Over there, the possibilities, but the woman didn't have enough leverage to do it, or it wasn't so makubal back then. She couldn't get it done, so this was her solution to deal with it. Amrle rovel rav nachum time amai, delo shavikinish nafshe v'yav l'achrine. The truth is, what's the reasoning behind this shtar mivrechet that we say that she definitely didn't give it to her daughter, because a person will not give something to another party to their detriment. So over here, if all the property goes there with the shtar mivrechet, then this person is left with nothing. So of course, that's not what their intent is. They will not benefit another party at their expense. And as Rava points out to Rav Nachman, that's only true when you're dealing with third parties. Of all the brato, yihiva. But when it comes to a daughter, there we wouldn't say that. With regards to children, and we've mentioned this before again in the Masechta, that when it comes to children, a person might give them precedence even over themselves, that they might gift them property even in advance of the Yerusha, but they would do this because it's their children. And children are different than third parties. And because of that, he's saying over here, maybe you shouldn't have ripped up the shtar mivrechet, because here she gave it to her daughter. And in giving it to her daughter, then maybe she did intend to give the gift fully and not to take it back. Versus the case where we had this earlier in the Masechta, where an individual gives the property and then it turns out that they need the income from this and they can't get it back because they gave it to their child. So we say to them, go earn. If you can earn again, then you replace it. So over here also, why is it when she grants it to the daughter that we actually reverse this? Afilu achi, makom brato, nafsha adifalo. So the Gemara says no, but in the face of a daughter, we still will say that the person themselves will take precedence. So even though you would have been midayek, that the daughter is not that type of third party, that it's only achrine, where we say that a person won't leave their own benefit and grant it to a third party, but for a daughter, they would do that. Nevertheless, what we're saying here is, v'makom brata nafsha adifalo. In this case, when it's her own sustenance, her own benefit, she would take precedence even over her daughter. So meitave, is that really true? Harotzeya shetavriach nechasemi bala, ketzad yosa. Person wants to have her property evade being collected by or taken as Yerusha by the husband. What should she do? Kotevet shtar pasim acherim. Divrei Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. She writes a shtar pasim to someone else. So Rashi writes over here, it's a shtar piyusim, that you have to convince the other party to accept the gift, because it's a gift that they're going to get no benefit from. You're not really gifting it to them, you're just gifting them to evade collection by another party. V'achamim omrim, ratza mitzachek ba, ash dektiv tov lo meyom ulu kisher tzeh. The Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and say that the recipient here can play games and basically say, I have a shtar, I'm going to keep the property, you want the property back, you're going to have to pay up. Or you basically can hold the person ransom because they have a real shtar that says that they were gifted the property. So from the Chachamim, it sounds like that the reason that you can get this property back is only if you follow their formula, which is ad shetichtov lo mayom uklasher tzeh. That says in the property, this gift is mayom until I want. Time mo dichtov lehochi. That's only because she incorporated that language in the contract. Halo katv lehochi. Had she not incorporated that language in the contract, kaninu lo keach, then the purchaser, or really here it's the recipient of the gift, would be the true owner of the property. If they're the true owner of the property, you can't rip up the shtar mivrechet. So the question is, why are you ripping up the shtar mivrechet from two levels. One level is, it seems like it's only true by third parties, but by her daughter, she would have given precedent. And even if you say over here that the daughter doesn't get precedence over her personal benefit, so we're going to rip up the shtar, nevertheless, we have the Tosefta telling us that the Chachamim believe that this type of shtar is a shtar in full force until she words it properly, which is, Me'ayom l'kashe erze. Okay, two things just to review with the Tosefta. The Tosefta quotes the shtar pasim. Shtar pasim we saw back earlier in the Masechta, back on, I think, Daf Yutet, that a shtar pasim, you're not allowed to hold. It's illegal to hold a shtar pasim, which is some sort of false shtar or shtar that is just put out in order to protect someone from a creditor. Whatever the reason for shtar pasim, you're not allowed to hold them. All of a sudden over here, we're talking about a shtar pasim that you're allowed to hold. So the difference, pointed out by the Rishonim, is that here the shtar is a full-fledged shtar. It's a proper shtar. It's signed by Edim. There's nothing wrong with the shtar. So over here, we're not talking about shtar pasim in the true sense of a shtar pasim. It's just a shtar that works like a shtar pasim. The only difference is that this shtar pasim actually is a proper shtar that works. So we're not using shtar pasim as the real meaning, but rather as a borrowed term to indicate it's a shtar that's being used to keep parties away from the property. Number two is, what does it mean that she writes in the shtar, Me'ayom, from today, u'l'kashi eretzeh, and when I want. So Rashi writes over here that it means there is no kinyan. She basically controls the gift. And she is saying that when I want, it'll be a gift. When I don't want, it won't be a gift. So if the individual who she gifted to comes and makes a claim, she'll say, no gift. It's not a gift now. Her husband comes and tries to collect the property, she'll say, it is a gift. And because when I want it, she can turn it on and off as she pleases. That's the way Rashi reads it. The simpler way to read it, and the Rishonim quote this in the name of the Rabbeinu Chananel, is Mayom Elkesh Eretzeh, which seems to be solving the problem that the Chachamim are indicating, is that it is a gift today, Elkesh Eretzeh, and I can turn it off when I want. So if you try to hold this gift and say, oh look, I have a shtar, it's mine, I can then say, it's off. The gift's off. But until that point in time, it is a gift. The nafka mina is what we just discussed, which is the party or the recipient, what is their entitlement in the interim? What is their entitlement in the interim to eat the peirot and to benefit from the property? If you read it like Rashi, the answer is no, because the gift isn't turned on until she says it's on. And she only turns it on when the husband comes to make a claim, and she turns it off when the other party comes to make a claim. In that scenario, the recipient gets nothing. That's what we said before. Rashi says, start you see me. You have to convince the recipient to take it because they're taking something without any benefit. On the other hand, if you read it like the Rabbeinu Chananel, then the recipient is the recipient until she turns it off. And if that's the case, then the recipient of the gift would be the beneficiary of the land or the payroll to the production during that period of time because they own it during that time. And it would be similar to a matana, amanat achzir, or amanat that when I want it, I can take it back. So also has nafkamino in terms of if the woman predeceases her husband. The woman predeceases her husband, who's the inheritor of this property? Because if you learn like the Rabbeinu Chananel, which is that the other party is the recipient of the gift until she turns it off, that means that even after she has passed away, seemingly it would remain with the recipient of the gift because she never turned it off. She never said, L'kashe erzeh, when I want it back, because she passed away. That means that the gift would stay with the lokeach. Whereas according to Rashi, the property really remains in her domain. And since it remains in her domain, then if she predeceases her husband, then the roles of Yerusha will take over. It's machloket rishonim, whether a husband inherits his wife midoraita or midorabanan. Certainly if you believe that a husband inherits his wife doraita, if she still owns the property and then she predeceases her husband, then that property would go to her husband. She was only doing this shtar avrocha while she was alive. But when she passes away, then she can't turn it on, like Rashi says. It's not on, unless she turns it on. And since she didn't turn it on, it's her property. She predeceases her husband, it's going to go to her husband. Her husband will inherit her. But even according to those that say the Rabbanan, because she didn't turn it on, that would seem to indicate that it remains in her possession and her husband would inherit in this case. So there are nafka minot as how you view the phrasing here of the gift, as whether it's a gift that can be turned off, or it's not a gift, but it can be turned on to protect her, as to, first of all, during the lifetime of the gift, who is the beneficiary? And number two is, at the point of death, if she predeceases her husband, who is the inheritor of that property? So now, the question is, we don't have this language that was found in the contract that Rav Nachman ripped up. So why is Rav Nachman ripping up a contract when we have in the Tosefta the Chachamim say you need this language? Amar Rabbi Zeira, lo kasha. Ha bekula, ha bemiktzata. Depends on how big the gift was or how much was gifted. So when Shmuel says, you're not koneh, that's when she writes all of her property and gives all of her property. Since she left nothing for herself, anan sade, that the lo gamra machnia. It's similar to a matana v'shchid meira, where a person gives all the property to the individual. We know we're anan sade. The only reason they're doing it is because they think that they're going to die or something's going to happen to them. If a person would give only a portion of their property to the individual, then it would seem that they're gifting it irrespective of what happens to them in the end. Because why do they leave anything behind? They left something behind because they had some suspicion that this, they may not die or this may not happen to them. Assuming that they did this in a conscious effort to dispose of their property, if they dispose of all their property, then it's clear that the only reason they did it is because they believed that they weren't going to need the property anymore. On the other hand, if it's sota, they give a portion of the property, that seems more like a gift than a disposition of all their property. So there's the same thing as here. If she gives all of her property, then anan sade, the lo gamra machnia, she clearly didn't give it all to her daughter because she wants it back if she needs it. And therefore, anan sade, that's the case. On the other hand, if she only gives a portion of the gift, then the recipient of the gift can play around and say, listen, you gave me a full gift, you have your own property left, this is mine. Until she writes in the contract, that language is meayom ulukishe erze. So that's the distinction we'll make. So now the Gemara says, v'ilo kaninu lokeach, nikninu bal. Now the Gemara asks a more general question. Question if it's a general question or is it a question directed at Shmuel, which is that if you believe over here that the Shtar Mivrechet is really not a Shtar, as Rav Nachman ripped it up, he's a Talmud of Shmuel, he ripped up the Shtar Mivrechet, and we're saying over here that the woman really has the rights to the property when she gets divorced and she can take it back from her daughter. That means that the gift is really not a gift. If it's not a gift, then the husband has it. You can't have it both ways, in a sense. If you believe that the Shtar Mivrechet doesn't work, that means that the property never left the woman's possession. If it didn't leave the woman's possession, then the husband has rights to the property. If it did leave the woman's possession, and that's what's protecting her from the husband, then the recipient really has it. So, in this case where you say she gifted everything to the daughter, then if it's going to be efficacious in protecting her from the husband taking the property, that means the daughter really got it. On the other hand, if we say that it's not effective, and it's not really with the daughter, and she can take it back, that means then it's really hers. If it's really hers, then the husband should get it. How do you reconcile with this idea that the property is nowhere? Now, according to Rashi's explanation, you wouldn't say this in the Achtiov lo mayom she'erzeh, because there, Rashi says it gets turned on and off. When you want it, you can turn it on, you can turn it off, and there you can escape in that way, so you have that right. But then we would have to ask on Shmuel's position in particular, how does this work? If he's saying that we rip up the shtar in the end, that means that whatever she did to have the possessions be out of her husband's right, she was unsuccessful at doing because they never went to the other party. But on the other hand, we know for sure that she doesn't want them to go to her husband, so that means that she really meant to give the gift. If that's the case, why are we ripping up the shtar? The shtar should be a good shtar, and the gift should be a good gift. So now the question is, how does it function? If it doesn't really work, if it's not a real shtar, then how is it functioning? Amar Abaye, sum kenechasim she'en yiduim labal. It's similar to property that is not known to the husband, which we said yesterday within Rabbi Shimon's opinion. And that's what the Gemara says, v'aliba de Rabbi Shimon, according to Rabbi Shimon, that when the husband doesn't know about the possessions, then he doesn't have a right to those possessions. So by writing the Shtar Mivrechet, basically she makes them into property that is not known. Not known to the husband because the husband doesn't think of that property as being within the purview of the marriage. Okay, he says, oh look, there's a Shtar Matana, therefore it must belong to someone else, and then he doesn't consider that to be property. Whether the Shtar is real or not is not as important because it's all about the mindset of the husband. And here the husband believes that this is not property that belongs to his wife. And when he marries her, he doesn't intend to get the property. And so that's how it works. Now there's a machloket in the Rishonim as how to read this. V'aliba de Rabbi Shimon doesn't mean that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon, and that's what Abaye is pointing out. That it's nechasim, she'enan yiduim lebaal, like Rabbi Shimon, because the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon. Or are we saying that, like Rabbi Shimon is an example of this, but here the Chachamim would agree. It's not that the Aloch is like Rabbi Shimon, but it's like Nechassim Sheinim Yidum. Here even the Chachamim would agree with these Nechassim, similar to what Rabbi Shimon says in his opinion, but not that the Aloch is like Rabbi Shimon. Tosafot over here says that it's clear that the Gemara means that the Aloch is like Rabbi Shimon, because it says the Vav. Ve'aliba de Rabbi Shimon. If you were right about that they were just using Rabbi Shimon as an example, it should have just said, Sheinim Yidum Nabal Aliba de Rabbi Shimon. But here, where it says ve'alibid Rabbi Shimon, that's clearly indicating that the locha is like Rabbi Shimon, and therefore Tosfa brings actual case. There was a case that came before the Rabbeinu Tam with a shtar mivrechet. He wanted to borrow money, but he didn't want the creditors to have a lien on this property. So he wrote a shtar mivrechet in order to have the property out of his possession when the loan was granted, so that they would not have a lien on this property. And he also wrote it in order that the ktubav, his wife, would not have rights to his property. Again, the same thing. His wife is a creditor, and so she will not have rights or lien on this property because he's now rid himself of ownership of this property. That the shtar that he wrote, the shtar mavriach, those recipients of the gift can collect on it. And he has no right to undo it. The davka hochi. Why does it only work here? Abayi just told us why it works here. It works here because I like Rabbi Shimon. According to Rabbi Shimon, the reason that it works here is because these are like nechasim, she'enam yiduim nabal, that are not known to the husband. But that's in the context of a marriage where the husband's coming in, and if the husband doesn't know about the property or the outside of what he thinks the woman owns, then he doesn't get rights to it. Over there, by the case of the creditors and the debtors, you can't say that. When he wrote the Shtar Mivrechet, he wrote it to a third party. That wasn't in the context of marriage. That was in the context of a transaction. The Daf Ki Hocha Mivrechet Zelo Kani Luhu Bal. Dabich Nechassim Shein Yiduim. Amreinim Devad El Avriach Nitkavein. Aval B'may Simeilu Zelo Vi Kani Lo Keach. In this case, if the recipient of the gift was not Koneit, Havi Kani Luhu Bal Chol Vaisha, then the creditors would have rights to the property. Because the creditors have full rights here, and you gotta choose. One of the two parties here owns the property. Either it's the creditors have a lien on the property and have rights to the property, or the recipient of the gift has it. You can't say, like we say in our Gemara here, oh, it's a property that you didn't know about. That's not true. That's a din in the bout specific to a husband. It's not a general din. And therefore, since he really wanted this property to be evade the liens of the creditors and his wife in the terms of the Ketubat Isha, then it's a full-fledged gift. And the recipients of the gift could keep it. And Rabbeinu Tam said that they were true recipients of this gifted property, and he could not unwind it. All right, next Mishnah. Nafula ksafim, ilakach behen karka. If she got money through the Yerusha, then the husband should purchase property with it. Basically, that's the equivalent of depositing it in the bank and earning interest on it. That was considered to be the safest investment at their time, was to buy karka because it didn't go anywhere. And it also had produce, meaning that it had dividends from owning the property. V'uochel peirot, and he eats the peirot, like the husband's rights in nechsei malog. Peirot ha-tlushim min ha-karko. If, once you came into the marriage, there were fruits on the property that were already picked, yilakach ben karka, they should purchase property with them. V'uochel peirot. So then he would eat the peirot. So the assumption being that peirot that are already picked are considered to be the equivalent of ksafim, or money now that she's bringing in, and you need to make them into Karen. They're payroll, and now you need to make them in Karen because she owns them. Since they're hers, he's got to make it into karka in order to preserve it, and then eat the payroll. Payroll to mechubarim bekarka. If the payroll, she brings in a field that is loaded, ready to be harvested, then those payrolls, Amar Rabbi Meir, shamin ota, kamehi yafa, bepayroll, bekamehi yafa, below payroll. You look at the value of the field with these payroll on it. And you look at the value of the field without these peirot on him. Omotar yilakech ben karka v'uchel peirot. And the excess, or the differential in that price, he will use to buy karka, because those are considered to be keren. Since they are keren or karka, he's got to give that value into karka. And then whatever grows from that point forward, that will be his value, or his money, and they will be considered peirot. So basically, at the point of marriage, anything that is grown already in terms of peirot on the karka, whatever stage they're up to, that value is considered to be keren, and he has to buy karka from it. Anything from that point forward is considered to be peirot, and they will be his. So he takes the differential between the property without anything on it versus the property with whatever's grown on it until this point. That differential is considered to be Karen. That's hers. Versus the growth afterwards, which will be his, because those are payrolled from her Nixay Malog. The Chamim Omrim, Amuchuberim the Karka, Shalom. The payrolled that are attached to the ground belong to him, because those are payrolled. Vatlushim in a Karka, Shalom. Those that are already picked are considered to be Karen, the equivalent of Safim. They're hers, Vilakach Behen Karka. And therefore you will buy with them land, Vuchel payrolled. Similar to what the Tanakhama said in that case. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Makom Shiafek Kocho B'Knisata, and the place where he has stronger position B'Knisata, when the marriage begins, Hora Kocho B'Tziata, his power is diminished in the case of Geushin. Makom Shehora Kocho B'Knisata, where his power is diminished at the point of marriage, Yafek Kocho B'Tziata, he has a much stronger position in divorce. Based on what the Chachamim just said before in the Gemara, then I ask, isn't this the position of the Chachamim? The Chachamim already said before that if they're mechuberim the karka, if they're attached to the ground, they're his, because they're considered to be peirot. So that's at the point of marriage, he has the upper hand there, and they're his if they're mechuberim the karka. At the point of divorce, if they're still attached to the land, they're shalah, they become hers, and he has no rights in them. And just the reverse with tlushim. If they're already picked the peirot, upon entrance into the marriage, they belong to her, and he has to buy karka with them. Versus in the case of divorce, if they're already picked, they're his, and he gets to keep them because they were picked before the marriage dissolved. Ketzad, peirot ha-mechuberim. So here's the example. Peirot ha-mechuberim, the karka, b'knisata shelo. Peirot that are attached to the ground upon the beginning of the marriage are his. U'b'yitziata shela. And at the end of the marriage, the termination of the marriage, they are hers. Vatlushim in a karka, those that are separated from the ground, knisata shala, upon the entrance into the marriage, they are hers, and you have to buy karka with them. Vitziata, upon the dissolution of the marriage, shalo, they're his because they're already picked and they were peirot, or classified as peirot prior to the dissolution of the marriage. So the Gemara now moves on and says, pshita, ara ubate. If I have land or houses, to buy with the money that the woman brought into the marriage. We're going to put it into the bank or to the safety deposit. How do I do this? If I have a choice between buying land or buying a house, Gemara says it's clear, ara, that you buy land. In this case, land is a better investment because land always stays there, has payroll, has dividends to it. A house, while it has rental income, the house wears down or has depreciation in it, and therefore it's a wasting asset. You're much better at getting the land than buying the house. Now Rashi claims over here that either one of the parties has a right to object. She can object because she wants the Karen to stay around. He can object because he says that if the Karen disappears, his payroll will diminish over time. The rental income will diminish over time versus the land where the production will be better or more consistent over time. So Rashi claims that either party has the right to demur over here and say that I want property and not houses. Seemingly, if both agree, they could buy a house, they could invest in real estate and rental income versus the land. On the other hand, the Reed says, Avali ma'isha rutza lahefech in abal yechol akev. The Tosfot Reed, similarly, it's only the wife's prerogative to object, it's not the husband's prerogative to object, and that's what's meant over here. Now we have the next setup, which is bate v'dikle. If I have a choice between buying houses for rental income or a palm tree, over there, bate, houses take precedence, because houses are a longer living asset, they depreciate more slowly, versus a tree that can dry out all of a sudden, or could stop giving fruit all of a sudden, so it's a much more risky asset in terms of both the keren and the production, and therefore I would opt for housing over a deco. Dikle vilone, if I have a choice between a palm tree and other trees, dikle, I would give precedence to the palm tree, seemingly because the palm trees are more consistent and longer living trees. And so it's a safer investment to be in the palm trees than it is to be in regular trees. That's what the Kalim is Kayim Harbe. It seems that the palm tree is a stronger, longer lasting asset than other trees that produce fruit. Ilane Vigufane. If you have a choice between fruit producing trees and a vineyard, Ilane, pick fruit trees. So if I'm here, it seems that a fruit tree is a better investment than a vineyard. Tosfot already raises that issue and says that in other places we find that that's not the case, that a vineyard is much more productive and is more valuable than an orchard or fruit-bearing trees. So Tosfos makes an interesting distinction, which is actually true. He says that a vineyard is a better investment, but it takes a lot of upkeep and a lot of continuous investment over time. And so if you're willing to make that investment and to take care of the property over time, then you're right. The vineyard would be a better investment than the tree. But if you're simply looking at them without strong investment and work in the property, then a tree would trump. It's an easier asset to deal with than the gufani, than the vineyard, and that's what's being expressed over here. All right, so now we have the Gemara moves on and says, Abba zardato upere dekavre. Question here of how many items that we have here. Rashi claims that there are actually three items over here. Abba is a yar, forest. Zardato is ilanot shel ozradin. These are the tree's sorb tree that is used for its wood, and it doesn't give significant fruits, and therefore they cut it for its wood. Opere de Cavre is a, Rashi says over here, a vivier. It's a fish pond that you have in the ground. So Rashi claims that there are three things. Most read it otherwise, which is abazar dato, a forest or a thicket of sorb, and then pere de Cavre, that there are only two items here, not necessarily three items that are listed over here. So amri la pere, vamri la karno. Some say that these are deemed to be perot, and some believe that these are deemed to be karen. So the one, as Rashi explains over here, the one who believes that they are perot, that is because the land itself is the keren. And so the trees that were on it that are used for lumber, they are considered to be the perot, and the land itself is the keren. It's similar to the fish pond. The land itself is the keren, and the fish pond is the perot. So that's one way to look at it. And therefore the husband would be entitled to cut the wood down, to take the lumber or to take the fish out, because those are perot versus the keren. Others say no, that they are the keren. If you cut down all the trees, then there's no forest left, there's nothing left here. So that's the keren. Therefore, you'd have to cut the trees down, sell them, and buy property with those trees, because they're classified as part of the keren. And then with the fish pond, the pond itself and the fish in it, that's the keren. So if you take fish out of it, that's not perot, that's what's there. That's a fish pond. That is exactly what it is. So you take the fish out, you have to sell the fish, buy karka with it, and then you can have perot from it. So that's the machloket here. Right, so that's the other side of it. The one who believes that it's perot says that's exactly. The fish reproduce, the trees can be regrown, or the anafim, the branches on the trees, once you cut them, when you prune them, they can regrow. So maybe in that case, they are considered to be perot. All right, so now the Gemara makes a statement, klalo de milta. What's the basic idea over here? What is the summary of what we're saying here? We have the Girsa of Rashi now, which is Gizo Machlif. If it is something that reproduces, comes back again and again, that's called Perot. Ein Gizo Machlif, if it doesn't come back again, then it is Karna, that's Keren. The way Rashi is defining it, this is basically a summary of the last statement. As Rashi says over here, Ilan Ein Gizo Machlif. If you cut a tree down, then Ein Gizo Machlif, it doesn't grow back again. So if you cut a tree down and it doesn't grow back again, then the tree is considered to be keren and not perot. Something that comes back over and over again, that would be classified as perot. So if you have something that reappears or can reproduce, that's perot. Something that doesn't reproduce itself, that's considered to be keren. And you can use that as your guidepost for what's here. As the Tosafot Arid explains over here, perish kol ilan shim techtechtenu gizo machlif. If you cut down the tree, it regrows. V'yotzi acher b'mkamon, another one comes there. Peirahave, that's called peirot. V'yachol dekotzol, and therefore you can cut it down because it replaces itself. Imen euse peirot, od yachlif yekeren liisha. Therefore you can cut this tree down if it's not a fruit-producing tree. Shod yachlif yekeren liisha, because it will replace itself, it will regrow, and that'll be the keren for the woman. Aval imen gizom achlif, if the tree does not regrow, like lumber in the forest. The fish in the fish pond, Haim Karna, they are the keren itself. And he shouldn't take any of them because they do not replace themselves. And therefore they're not deemed to be perot, but rather as keren. That's similar to the way Rashi reads the Gemara over here. The Rabbeinu Chananel actually has, and Tosafot quotes the Rabbeinu Chananel, that the opposite girsa, exactly the opposite, which is Rabbeinu Tam Goros to Rabbeinu Chananel, and Rabbeinu Tam liked the girsa of the Rabbeinu Chananel, again, which was Gizo Machlif Karna, If it reproduces, it can be strange. That's Karen. Engizo machlif perot. If it does not reproduce, then it is perot. So now the Rabbeinu Tam explains it. This is not talking about property that fell to Rabbi Yerusha. Whether you can sell them or not. Rather, the Ari binaflula ksafim. Same had a case where she gets money. Va'akai plugtayu. And this is what they're asking. Shim naflula ksafim. Rotzea balik not behem abazardato per de kavre. And here, it's not the case where she got these as Yerusha. And now we're trying to determine which piece of it is Karen and which piece of it is Perot. So we know what belongs to the husband, what belongs to the wife. But rather, what the decision here is that she got money. Now that she has money, what should we do with it? What should we buy with it? So can he buy a forest with it? Can he buy a fish pond with it? Something that produces over and over again, that is considered to be Karen. So if you buy something that keeps on producing, then you bought something that is classified as Karen. That would be classified as Karka, and he can use the wife's money to do that. If you buy something that is a one-time use, it's going to disappear after you buy it, then that's not considered to be Karen, and you cannot invest your money in that. That's investing your money in Perot instead of Karen. So then, based on the Rabbeinu Tam's explanation over here, if, for instance, he really did get a fish pond, or he really did get a forest as part of the Yerusha, he would be entitled to keep utilizing until there was nothing left. He could cut all the lumber down until there's nothing left, or he could take all the fish out until there's nothing left, because that's not what the Gemara is discussing over here. Gemara is discussing if she gets money, what can you invest the money in? Can you invest it in a forest? Can you invest it in a fish? And the Gemara lays out the principle about what's considered to be Karen and what's considered to be Perot. If it keeps producing, that's Karen. If it doesn't keep producing, that's Perot. Right, so now the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Zera, Amar Rabbi Oshai, Amar Rabbi Yanai. Vamrila, and some say it was Amar Abba, Amar Rabbi Oshai, Amar Rabbi Yanai. Have Gonev, Vlad, Behemat, Milog. Someone who steals a offspring of an animal that was brought in as Nixle Malog. So Nixle Malog, come on, they produce a offspring, and that offspring now was stolen. Mishalem Tashlume Kefel Isha. So then the Ganav, who stole it, has to pay Kefel if he's caught. If he's caught and he has to pay Kefel, that Kefel goes to the woman and not to the husband. Now the truth is, you would actually subdivide it, because the Kefel is made up of Karen and of the fine of the Kefel. As far as the Karen is concerned, the husband actually owned, these are Perot. These are Perot of the Nixle Malog. The offspring of the Nixle Malog are Perot, and they belong to the husband. So as far as the Karen is concerned, the Karen would actually go to the husband. On the other hand, the Kefel, the additional fine that's placed on top, that would belong to the woman, because we worry about the fact that the mother or the original behemoth might die. And if the animal dies, then this would, in a sense, be the replacement for the Karen, for the original mother. So if that's the case, it's really hers in that sense. Tosfot over here speaks about that it's actually turned out to be very interesting, which is that if you stole the Nixle Malog itself, and the Ganav would be Chayav Kefel, that Kefel would go to the husband, because that would be considered to be Perot of the Nixle Malog. On the other hand, if it's the offspring of the Nixle Malog, then the Kefel goes to the woman, which seems to be counterintuitive. This is that the thing that the woman really owns, the husband gets the kefil from. The thing that the husband really owns, the woman ends up getting the kefil from. So Tos in the end says, maybe the Gemara doesn't mean exclusively from the offspring. Maybe it means even by the case of the Nixle Malog itself, she would also get kefil. But that's obvious. The question is, but the offspring of the Nixle Malog, that she would also be entitled to the kefil over here. Come on, who's this like? Loki Rabbonon. It's not like the Rabbanan or Chananya, the Tanya and the Bright that we find. Vlad Behemat Milog. The offspring of the Behemot that are brought in as Nixle Milog to the marriage, Labal. They belong to the husband. Vlad Shivchat Milog. The offspring of maidservants that are brought into the marriage as Nixle Milog, Lisha. They belong to the woman. Chananya ben Achi Yoshaya Amar. Chananya, the nephew of Yoshaya, said, Asu Vlad Shivchat Malog, Kivlad Behemat Malog. So that the offspring of the maidservants belong to the husband, just like the offspring of the animals belong to the husband. So in that case, nobody says that the offspring of the animals belong to the woman, or that she should be entitled to the kefel. Where it says, Afil Tema Divrei Hakol. Maybe this is according to everyone. Peirei Takinu Le Rabbanan. The Rabbanan granted the individual peirot. That's what the husband gets. Takat Pirkona, for redeeming her, he gets the Perot, he gets the leasehold, the production of the fields or the nixei malog that she brings in. Peira, the peira, lo takinu le'rabanan. But the derivatives of the derivative, they did not grant to him. So in Ochanami, the animal itself, the nixei malog that produces offspring, that animal belongs to the husband. But that, what that animal produces, now becomes peira de peira. The kefel that it produced is a fruit of its fruit. It's a second derivative. The second derivative wasn't granted to him. That goes back to the woman. And that's what I said before. The Tosfot points out the absurdity here, which is that she will be the beneficiary when he owns it, and he will be the beneficiary when she owns it. Because the output or the leasehold of the nixei malog belong to the husband. But those peirot that belong to the husband, if they have output or derivatives to them, then it will go back to being owned by the wife. And as Tosfot points out of here, it's not that all peire de peire do not belong to the husband, because we see in other places, further on the Masech, they were going to say that they do. The peirot of the peirot do belong to the husband. But rather, dafka mide de ante mi alma, things that come from the outside that are derivative benefits of these peirot, that is considered to be the property of the woman and not of the man. On the other hand, if it's a direct benefit from the object itself, then peri de peri would belong to the husband. Or in other words, something that's matsui would belong to the husband, and something that is less likely to transpire and is a derivative of the peirot, that would belong to the isha. Now where it says, Bishlam al-Chananya, according to Chananya, dehainu delo chashin al-Mita, we don't worry about death. Since he's consistent, we don't worry about the original animal dying, and we don't worry about the original maidservant dying. That's why the offspring belong to the husband. Because her nixei malog will remain intact. And since the animal or the maidservant's there, we don't worry about the husband taking the peirot. El rabbanon, ich aishu lemita. If they worry about the keren disappearing because the item's gonna die, afilu v'lai b'im malog na'amilo. Then in that case, the offspring of the animals also should not belong to the husband. They should belong to the woman as protection for her keren, for her nixei malog. V'ilu chayshu lemita. If they don't worry about death, then I feel of Vladshiv Chai Malog Nami. Then the child of the maidservant should also belong to the husband because she still has the maidservant intact. Olam Chayshe the Mito. They do worry about death. Shiny Beima Dika Ura. That animal is different because even if the original animal that was Nixei Malog that she brought into the marriage, even if it dies, it still has residual value, which is Ura, the skins. You can flay it afterwards and use the skins. So it has residual value. So what the Gemara is establishing over here, and the Gemara will take it up in more detail in a minute, is that as long as there's something left of the Karen, then we don't worry about it. It's only when the Karen is going to disappear completely do we worry about the Nixei Malog not being Nixei Malog anymore, because she'll have nothing left. As long as there's at least some residual there, we consider it to be the Karen, and the husband can benefit from the utility of whatever this object is or whatever this item is. So I'm Ravuna Barchi, I'm Shmuel. Halacha ke Chananya. The halacha is like Chananya, that the husband gets the output no matter what. We don't worry about the Karen disappearing. Amar Rova, Amar Rav Nachman, af agav damar Shmuel halacha ke Chananya. Even though he says the halacha is like Chananya, modeh Chananya, shim nitgasha v'notenet damim v'notautan. That if she gets, if they get divorced and she wants back the shifcha that was a part of her household, that she can pay for it, mipnei shevach beit avia. Because of the glory of her father's house. Since these maidservants and this family of maidservants was in her father's house forever, therefore she has a right, even though the husband, technically they're deemed to be peirot, her offspring are deemed to be peirot, and they belong to the husband. And that means that even after a divorce, the husband would keep the offspring and the maidservant would stay with her. Nevertheless, she has a right to pay for it and take it back. Not that she gets it for free, she has to compensate the husband, but she has the first right of refusal there to pay for it, because of this idea of Shevach Beit Aviyah. Because it belonged to her father's house at one point, and it's a part of the glory of the house. Amarov, Amarav Nachman, Hichnisa lo eiz lechalva. He brought in a goat for her milk. Virachel legizata. A ewe for its wool. As Rashi points out, that doesn't preclude it from the milk as well. You also get the milk there. Vitarnagolet the beitzata. Or a chicken for its eggs. V'dekel the peirutav, a palm tree for its dates. Ochel v'olech ashe tichle akeren. He can utilize it all the way along until there is no principle that is left. So again, the idea that there's no principle left doesn't mean that there is completely nothing left, but there is some value, residual value that is left afterwards. So you can utilize the item, and in the end, there's some minimal value that's left. Rav Nachman, Ailale Glima, she brought in a cloak or a coat into the marriage as part of a nifse malog. Pere have nifse beva zilad dekalya. The perot, or the utility here, is his wearing it. And he can wear it until it wears down. Wears down to the point where there's a small residual to it. But since there's a small residual, that is fine. Whereas the Ramban explains this Gemara differently and says that when we're talking about Eis Lechalba and Rachel Legizotea, we're talking about that the woman doesn't own the underlying animal, just the output or the product that's here. And the husband is entitled to eat these perot in this instance, even though technically there will be nothing left afterwards, and that's because they are a defined quantity or object that will come out every year, and that makes them like perot. And he's allowed to eat the perot, even though there'll be nothing left. And therefore, unlike Rashi and Tosafot, the Ramban believes, even if the Karen's wiped out entirely, that is fine. Like, for instance, by the cloak. If he wears the cloak and it's worn down and there's nothing left of it, that'd be fine because it's a discrete object whose utility is to be worn. And therefore, if he wears it to the point where it doesn't exist anymore, that is still considered to be the perot of that object. Kiman, who is this like? Kihai Tana. It's like this author of this Braita. I mean, that what we're seeing over here, according to Amar Rav, Amar Rav Nachman, in all these instances that you're allowed to get the perot out of this item until you wear it down or to nothing, then who is the author of that position that you're allowed to do this? Tanya, Hamelach v'achol harizeh perot. If she brings in salt mines, or really the way Rashi writes it, it's on the coastline, that they have the water that fills up pools and they evaporate the water and make salt, the salt there is the perot, or the sand on the beach is perot. Because you can keep taking from them and they'll produce more. It'll always be there. You're not going to empty all the sand and you're not going to empty all the salt. You're just bringing the new water. So those are considered perot and the husband can be a beneficiary there and the Karen remains intact. Pier shel gafrit. If you have a sulfur quarry or machporet shel tsrif or an alum mine, Rabbi Meir Omer Karen. Rabbi Meir says that is the Karen because if you mine them continuously, eventually there'll be nothing left there. So if you take out of the sulfur quarry or out of the alum mine, eventually there'll be nothing left. So that's why it's considered to be Karen and you can't take from it. Chamim amim, perot. Those are perot and you can eat them up. You can continue to use them until there's nothing left. And as Rashi explains over here, shezeh perio v'derech hanato. That's the way to utilize it. And that is the benefit of this property. V'lad din neglima. And that's similar with a cloak. V'lo domo l'ksafim u'perot atlushim. Shenechalim b'li shior. As Rashi explains over here, these are different than monies or fruits that were tlushim when they came into the marriage. Those items, we said, they have to purchase karka with them. Why? Because there, when you utilize them or eat them up, there's zip. There's nothing left afterwards. V'chol puta puta ve'ena no simpri hu keren latzma. And therefore, every piece of value, since it will never be replaced or there's nothing left of it, there is no keren. But, on the other hand, over here and all these other items, there is something left afterwards. Even if you milk it till the point where it doesn't have any milk left, the eis is still there. The goats still exist. If you shear it and it no longer produces wool anymore, after, so here, I mean, it does reproduce, but after a certain time, it's not so productive, it's still there. The animal still exists. The mine. After you've mined everything out of the mine, there's still the mine itself. The land itself still exists. So there's always a karen left behind, even though there was perot, there was value that you were extracting from it. Those are considered to be the perot, and that's the Chachamim's position. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam suggested before in terms of the fish pond and the forest, that if the forest is considered to be, or the lumber is considered to be perot, and the fish are perot, he can take them until there's nothing left, because those are perot, and then the land that's left behind will be the Karen, will be the next same load that he leaves behind, similar to what we're saying here by the Pir Shel Gafrit and Choferet Shel Tzarif. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Makom Shiafe Kocho, we had Rabbi Shimon at the end of the Mishnah, where it says, Rabbi Shimon, I know Tanakama. Rabbi Shimon is similar to the Chachamim in the Mishnah. He's just explicating on the position of the Chachamim. So why is he a separate position? If they're attached to the ground at the time of the divorce, that's the difference between them. So as Rashi points out, talush b'shat yitziyah, everybody really agrees that the fruits were already picked before the divorce or the dissolution of the marriage, then clearly over there, they belong to him because they were perot and he had them prior to the marriage. But In this case, where they're still attached, at the time that they get divorced, who do they belong to? So there, Rabbi Shimon says, they're going to belong to the woman, because he didn't pick them yet, they weren't made into peirot. Chachamim will disagree and see those are already peirot, and the husband is entitled to them. Nafla avadim ushpachot zikenim. If she gets servants and maidservants that came to her that were older, imachru vilakach ben karka v'chol peichel peirot. You sell them, monetize them, and with that money, you purchase karka, and you eat the peirot, and the husband's entitled to eat the peirot, the production of that field. He should not sell them because these are considered to be the glory or the honor of her parents' house. If she gets olive trees or a vineyard zikanim that are already older and they're less productive, you sell them and you purchase land with it, and the husband's entitled to eat the production of that field that you buy. Don't sell them because these are the vineyards of this family, the orchard, the olive trees of this family, and therefore you wouldn't sell them because they're part of the family's estate, and you would not monetize them, but rather keep them on, even though they are less productive. Amarav Kana, Amarav, Machloket, Shnaflu, Bisadeh Shela. That's only true of these items. The vineyard or the olive trees came in her own property. But in the case where the property that comes to her here is not the actual underlying land, but rather the rights to the olive trees and the vineyards that are on the land. So her father had basically taken a long-term lease on the land and he had bought the rights to plant on the land, but he didn't own the land itself. So in that case, if she inherits them, then everybody would agree that you sell it off and then you buy land with it because Shem de Kakalia Karano. Otherwise, if the vines die or the olive trees die and they're no longer productive, then you have nothing left because the land didn't belong to him. He only had the rights to plant them. So in that case, we would monetize it according to everyone and then buy land with it because here there's no concept of Shevach Beit Avia because the Karen itself will disappear. There'll be nothing left once the vines or the olive trees die, there'll be nothing left for the woman at all. And in that case, there's no concept of Shevach Beit Avia. Matkvla Rav Yosef, Arei Avadim Ushvachot, Techi Sadeh Sheina Shela Dami. Well, don't Avadim Ushvachot have that same standing? Once they pass away, there's nothing left. And yet, Plige, they argue in our Mishnah on this point. Ela Itmar Hachi Itmar. If you want to, we should amend the statement to read this way. From Rav Kana Marav, which is, Rav Kana Marav, Machloket B'Sadeh Sheina Shela. Their Machloket is a case where she doesn't own the underlying land. It's just that they own the vineyards or the olive trees. Aval B'Sadeh Shela. But in a case where they do own the underlying land, Divrei Hakol Lo Timkor. Everybody agrees you shouldn't sell it off, Mipnei Shevach Beit Avia, because then that is the estate. This is a land that has been in their family for a very long time. And therefore, they shouldn't sell it. They should maintain the land, even though that which is on the land will no longer be productive. The land itself is important, and the husband shouldn't sell it off in order to purchase other land. On the other hand, in a case where they don't own the underlying land, they own the rights to the olive trees and the vineyards that are on the land, in that case, we have the machloket of our Mishnah as to whether they should sell them off and make them into keren that will last for a longer time. Or do we still say Shevach Beit Avia with regards to this olive grove? Or this vineyard, even though they don't own the underlying land, these are the grapes of this family and the olives of this family that have been known for many years. All right, we'll just read the next Mishnah, and then we'll continue with the Gemara tomorrow. Hamotzio tzaota nekseh ishto. Person who expends, invests in his wife's property. Hotzia bei v'achal kima. If his expenditures were great to maintain the property or invest in the property, v'achal kima. And he only got a small amount of benefit from it. Kima, if he invests very little in it, v'achal harbe, and yet he got tremendous benefit from the property. Mashotziotzi, what he expended or invested is done. Mashachalachal, and what he took. Meaning that there's no refunds over here. Whatever he invested is lost, and whatever he benefited, he got already. And in the case of divorce, there is no true up. We don't try to assess how much was invested versus how much was eaten in that period of time. Hotzi v'lo achal. On the other hand, if he had expenditures or invested in the property and never got any benefit from it, ishba kama hotzi, then he takes a shvua as to how much he expended, bito, and he'll take that money back since the investment was for naught because he got nothing out of the property whatsoever. In that case, we will allow him to get a refund of his investment in the property. Okay, we'll stop over here by the Gemara on the bottom of Ayin Tet Amud Bet.